you decoders, welcome back, and welcome to the new friendly and familiar faces we have. I know we've gotten some more listeners and some more likes, and so we really appreciate it. You know, the more you can spread the word on this thing, the more you can like it, the more you can help us achieve our goal of educating and reaching people. We have two new articles of interest. So one is a study that was published on extremophilic strains of bacteria and archaea from around the planet and how they're used to gain valuable insights on their behavior when you put them in harsh space environments. And then the next paper we have is a new meta-analysis, which is just a study of studies, suggesting that roughly 1 in 6 cases of COVID-19 were present without symptoms. So that's only 17%. So if you guys are interested in why this was done, how this was done, where did they get their data, go to our website and check out those articles. They're very interesting and they're very well written. So thank you to all of our volunteer writers and all of the volunteer staff that we have. So let's turn our attention to the topic of today. So we're actually going to be talking about something that's a little more controversial, which is climate change and climate change projections. So we're going to dive a little deeper into how climate change projections are created, and particularly in Dr. Adrian Wooten's recent publication, how statistics can best be applied to these models as we attempt to get more accurate pictures of our climate. Climate projections took on a new level of importance in the United States after the Global Change Research Act became law in 1990. This required that a public report on the state of climate in the United States and projections of the climate would be made every 4 years. Climate models are physically based representations of the climate, and these models typically produce climate projections, or simulations of the climate in the future, and they do it for the entire globe. These climate models project how the climate will respond to different scenarios of emissions of greenhouse gases, from human activities and societal growth and development, to anything else that you can really put in these simulations. The global climate models are intense computer programs which provide simulations of the global climate. Not surprisingly, these require supercomputing facilities to produce projections that cover the globe. However, because of these enormous computational requirements, global climate model simulations don't typically simulate the fine details of what's going on in the region. Sometimes these regional climate models can be quite complex, which can cause changes in their climate to be quite dramatic for a number of reasons. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Adrian Wooten about her climate science paper and what that has to say about climate modeling and the error that we might think is happening inside current climate projections. Welcome back, Science Decoders. I'm here today with Dr. Adrian Wooten. She is a postdoctoral research associate out of University of Oklahoma, correct?
Yes.
Yep.
And so she's going to be talking to us today about her most recent paper, which was published in Climate, The Effect of Statistical Downscaling on the Weighting of Multimodal Ensembles of Precipitation. So welcome, Adrian. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Of course. You know, we greatly appreciate any time a busy researcher can take time out of their schedule to join us and answer a few questions and get to share their fun discoveries with us. So your paper,
pleasure.
Oh yeah, for sure. So your paper centers around climate models that are based on or created from some extensive applications of real life data and statistics. Can you explain what scientists are using these models for?
So the climate models themselves aren't all entirely statistically based. They're really physically based. So there's lots of physical equations representing multiple processes in the atmosphere and the ocean and the interaction between atmosphere and ocean and land. So you have meteorology in there, you have oceanography in there, mm-hmm. and all of the physical equations that we know very well already. And those models then start with the they start with the different scenarios that we have for what kind of emissions that humans would put into the atmosphere and take that information into the global model, into the global climate model, I should say, and then run that forward to say this is how the climate at a global scale will react to that. There's some statistics involved in certain things that go on at a process level that is finer than what the model can show, which, for example, because we have limits on how much we can do in computation, every model has a what's called a resolution. And their resolution that they run at is basically how large those boxes are, how much space there is between points that it calculates on a model's grid. In the case of the global climate models, because they have to run for the entire world and go all the way out to, I think now in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the ones they're using go all the way to 2300 in time, projecting forward. The finest or the closest those grid points can be together is about 100 kilometers. And so that's where things like thunderstorms and what have you that still exist in the global model have to be approximated. So that's where statistics comes back into it, is those approximating features. But most everything in a global climate model is physically based. And I think the other part of your question was asking, what are we using them for currently? Or
did I get that right? Yeah. Okay. So what do you guys use these models for when you're looking at these changes that are going on, not just presently, but also projecting out to the future?
Mm-hmm. So in the past, the climate models generally have been used to research the climate system. We'll do something of a what-if scenario and work with the equations in the model to say something about if this happened in the climate, how would the, if this happened or this amount of emissions was put into the atmosphere, how would the climate respond to it? But also doing some research that we can't do with observational studies, or we can't do because we only have one planet to work with. We don't want to mess with it. So we simulate the planet in the global climate model and then start having some experiments of what goes on with different kinds of cloud formations or how aerosols interact with the environment. So things from volcanic eruptions, for instance, how does that influence the climate? So that's historically what they've been used for, is just research and improving our understanding of the climate as a system. But the other thing that we use them for more and more nowadays is they're being used, or I should say the projections that come out from climate models are being used to help us with planning and policy making at a global scale. So I've already mentioned the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's one such body that uses the output from climate model projections to say something to policymakers about this is how we think the climate is going to change. And then some other experts will make suggestions on what to do based upon that information. We have our own things here in the US with the National Climate Assessment that is really similar. And more at local scales and regional scales, one of the things that we'll use the climate models for is to inform impact assessments. So understanding how climate change impacts everything from agriculture to ecosystems, water quality and public health, all sorts of different things there. And then go on also to understanding what the vulnerabilities are we have in our current human society and in the natural world to a changing climate. And the other good example actually is also local policymaking. There's lots of local decision makers now who are recognizing that climate change may be an impact to their region, such as, for example, park managers in our local parks, interested in maintaining their lands and understanding what invasive species of plants may now be able to move into an area as the climate changes. That's one of the other reasons they want to get a handle on the projections from climate models, is to understand what kind of things they need to plan for and what decisions they need to make for long-term kind of planning. So 50 to 100 years from now, as opposed to what's going to happen next year or in the next 4 years in the election cycle or any number of different things. So these are planners who are thinking far longer term most of the time when they're looking at the climate projections.
Yeah, and since the science carries such weight and these models carry such weight in our policymaking, I think certainty is very important. So where does the certainty in these models and the certainty, you know, in the equations and in the process come from? Can you speak to that level of understanding, that level of knowledge, and that level of faith that we can actually have in these models and projections?
Sure. So one of the things that we do to help make sure that what we're providing is good for all the different things that we use for now is to do an evaluation on those projections and what they said about the current time that we're in, but also about the farther past. And particularly for the global climate models on that level, what they typically do for evaluation is they'll look at metrics that they were designed for, things about the global climate. So a typical variable that we sort of evaluate them on is how well do they replicate over time the global mean surface temperature and how that's changed since the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s. And the good news is actually they have done very well with that. So that's one of the reasons that gives us confidence that the global climate models are good in those kinds of things. And you notice I said good in those kinds of things because there are certain things, of course, now that we're trying to use them for that we know that the global models aren't there just yet to be perfect for. Mm-hmm. And that's totally fine. It's what they were originally designed for. And now we're evaluating them for things that they weren't originally designed to do, and adding all those complexities into it. But we also evaluate them for, do they generally speaking place hurricanes in the right place? Is the jet stream in the right place? Do the larger scale frontal systems and patterns that we expect to exist actually be there? Because of the way the global models are run, we don't ask necessarily, did this exact hurricane occur at exactly this time? Mm. Because the climate is more so about the average temperatures and average precipitation, but it's also about the frequency and average intensity of the extremes. So we more so want to know, do enough hurricanes occur? Not necessarily, did Hurricane Katrina show up in the climate model the way it was supposed to? That's more the domain of weather forecast modeling, where you're trying to get exact events perfectly right. Mm-hmm. And these kinds of things. So yeah, we do a lot of that. So there's the historical side of things. But and also in my work, we don't ignore the uncertainty that exists. There is uncertainty in the climate projections and in climate modeling. And that's okay for us on our side. We don't have a problem talking about it. Uncertainty in a communications literature on the general public side is typically viewed as a negative, which I can understand that. People want certainty. But we accept it because the global models and the climate all have the same, the global climate models, I should say, all have the same fundamental physics of the climate in them, conservation of mass and momentum and energy, all those kinds of things that you learn in your basics in physics. They're all there in the global climate models, and all the basic fundamental equations are exactly the same between them. But because this is still an active area of research at the same time as we're trying to make policy and decisions about it, there are things that we don't completely understand yet. And so there's about 4 dozen different global climate models right now. There's a tremendous number of them from different modeling centers from across the world. But the reason there are so many is because there are the components of the climate that we don't completely understand yet. Mm. And because of that, we don't have the exact same equations between them. And so there's different models there to represent the different possible theories for why certain parts of the climate functions the way it does. And that's the reason we end up with those different global models. And that can lead us then to the spaghetti plots that you sometimes see with projections of the future climate, because we want to capture that aspect of our uncertainty and actually translate that to a decision maker. One of the things we find is that decision makers are very capable of handling uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You just got to let them know that it's there and why it's there. So we often don't ignore that. We help package it up there and say, this is, you know, when we're talking about a mean projected change, for instance, we could also then say something from the whole collection of models and projections that we have about what's the extreme possible change and what's the best case. Not the best case. It's not the best scenario, but the lowest possible change that could occur. Mm-hmm. And that gives a decision maker a range to plan for. We often, at least when I provide projections, we tend to frown on the idea of just going with one thing, because if you're going with one thing and planning for that and you end up with something worse, well, that's going to be a problem down the road for somebody who is a planner. So that's one of the things we tend to avoid. But we try to make sure that people actually make use of the uncertainty, not that they ignore it necessarily. We have confidence in how good they are because of how well they represent the past, but we don't necessarily know how everything is exactly going to unfold in the future, which is part of the thing we have with the different theories for parts of the climate system we don't fully understand yet. This is why we have so many different global climate models and ways of looking at these things. We want to capture the uncertainty we have as scientists and translate that to somebody else who is going to be making use of it so they can plan for a range of options, not just this exact thing right here. Within a range of confidence, I can understand for some things there's way too much uncertainty and somebody's going to just throw up their hands and not want to deal with it. And that's totally fair too. We acknowledge that. But we try to make sure people incorporate the uncertainty in their planning and decision making. And when they do impact assessments also. So a good example of that is I will often provide projections for a hydrologist, for instance, and they will take the precipitation and temperature information and run that in a hydrology model and then say something about what's the stream flow going to be like of this particular river or the quality of the water in the river. And the reason that becomes important then to have them translate all of that is you're adding another modeling process on top of a modeling process. You have to make sure the uncertainty from one translates all the way through in the other. And so we make sure they try and use at least a representative sample of all the projections that are there. But we, of course, try to prefer that we try to get them to use all of it, but that's not necessarily feasible. It's a huge amount of data to work with.
Yeah, I can imagine. So in the previous question, you had mentioned that climate models should be used for specific things. And in some ways nowadays, they're being used outside of the designated go zone, I guess you could say. Can you give us maybe a little bit of a frame of reference for what you believe these climate models can be and should be accurately used for, as opposed to maybe some of the things that they shouldn't be used for that they are being used for now?
They can be used for a lot of different things. I don't want to say that they can't be used for doing assessments and looking at impacts, impact assessments and what have you, because they have been used very feasibly for that. But for example, if somebody's wanting to say that 50 years from now, we're on this day, 50 years from now, we're going to have this snowstorm or this hurricane that comes in and wipes out everything. That's not what that climate model is designed to do. It's designed to replicate the climate. And you can pull from a climate model what's going to happen on this day 50 years from now. But it's not accurate. I guarantee you that will not be exactly what happens that day 50 years from now. Although it could be. Not an impossibility. But things like that, using them for saying exact specific events, is not what the global models are designed for. But that said, you can still use the global models in any number of impact assessments so long as you're using something that's representative time-wise of the climate, not something that's representative of what's going on in weather. So, for instance, in the hydrology-related study that I just mentioned, we would make sure that they were using 30 to 40 to 50-year periods of data from the climate model to capture the range of what's going on in the climate and translate that all the way through to you. If you're talking about how climate change is going to affect this river that you're interested in, then you need to be looking at 30, 40, 50 years of the stream flow output at the same time, not just what's going to happen in one particular day. Another reason for not using a single year even from a global climate model, not just a single day, that's another bad application. Somebody using a single year in the climate model, that's a bad application too. And the reason for that is, Say you have your 30 years right now that's somewhat representative of current climate, and then you're pulling something from 50 or 60 years in the future. That 1 year in the future could be really warm, could be really cold, could be really wet, could be really dry. But because you're only pulling that 1 year, you don't know how reflective that is of the current climate that year is in. So it could be much warmer, and it could be about normal for what that future climate would look like. But it could also be much hotter than normal. But if you use that one future year to represent what the future climate is going to look like, it gives somebody a wildly inaccurate picture of the climate. Does that help? Because that's a couple of examples of ways things
get. Yeah, no, I really appreciated those examples. I thought they were very spot on. So turning more specifically to your paper, what was the hypothesis that you were looking to study and what were the variables and how did you define them?
So the global climate models themselves are programming code, essentially. And we take all these physical equations and turn them into a form that computers can use to help us project the changes in the climate. Where it becomes interesting, of course, is we recognize that people are people. We share programming code with each other. And one of the useful things that we can do to help others to see and understand how the climate will change instead of having 40 different things for them to look through is to take an average of those 40. And typically in the past, what the assumption has been is that each of those different global climate models are completely independent from each other. And so you can just equally weight every member and average them together and get something that makes sense. It was discovered in the last 15 or 20 years because of the recognition that people are very human, that I shouldn't say the last 15 or 20 years, more like the last 10 years, I apologize. You might have some editing to do with this one. But in the last 10 years, it was the recognition that, okay, wait, in this global climate model over here, it shares some similar programming code to this other global climate model over here. And because of that, they're not perfectly independent from each other. So that assumption is no longer accurate, and weighting everything equally doesn't make sense because the different global models, even though everything else about that model could be different, they could end up clustering toward the same solution of what the future climate is because of that one component that they share in common. They're not, because they're then at that point not perfectly independent. And the reason this became a concern is we do have a lot of concerns as a climate modeling community that we want to make sure that what we're providing we're confident in, but we don't present overconfidence at the same time. So if it's artificially clustering toward the same solution because they have components that are very similar to each other, then that's a problem. After that was discovered, the global climate modelers decided we're going to weight everything to try and capture that factor of independence, but also how skillful they are in the historical period at the same time. So that was developed and applied with the global climate models. Where I came into this is that what I actually work with is I don't run global climate models myself. I make use of their output. But what I do is that whole issue of there being the grid of 100 kilometers, for instance, that's a problem when you're getting into local and regional adaptation because, say you're in Puerto Rico, for instance, that island is very, very small, but it has some very dynamic changes in the climate over very short distance because of the mountains that run through the middle of the island. So in the space of 50 miles, the precipitation in the region goes from it on an annual basis, 30 inches on the southwest side of the island to 170 inches on the northeast side of the island in space of all of 50 miles. And that would be less than 100 kilometers. So if you think about it from the global climate models perspective, that difference between those two locations isn't there. It's represented in all of one number. That's the average essentially over that whole area. But that's not helpful because the ecology of the island reflects something of the climate at the same time. So in that 170 inches, that's a rainforest. But on the other side of the island where it's 30, it's actually a desert. So it's very different ecologically wise when people are planning, trying to plan using the climate models, having something that doesn't capture that difference doesn't help them. So what I do in my work is I try to translate what the global climate models say about that change to local scales in part. And that's a process that's called downscaling. We basically reintroduce all the effects of things like having complex topography or being really close to shoreline or having different vegetation in short distances can also influence the local climate of what's going on. All those things don't go away in the future, but we still have to represent them alongside of what the global climate models tell us the change is. So that's what I deal with primarily in the modeling side of things is how do we translate all of that large scale change to local scales? So that's a broader part of my research. But I had a realization as pertaining to this particular paper, because that's another modeling process, downscaling, regardless of exactly how you do it. It's another modeling process that's added on top of a modeling process with the global climate models. And so the realization that I had is that whole weighting we were doing with the global climate models to try and get the mean projected change. That was being done, and those weights were being created based upon the global climate models and then applied to global climate models that had been downscaled. Mm. The problem with that that we saw, and we hypothesized off of this, that it was ignoring the idea that you're adding a common modeling process on top of every single global climate model. And just like the issue with the common programming code between small groups of climate models, well, now you're adding some common programming and modeling effort to all of them all mm-hmm. at the same time. And so we hypothesized that that reduced the independence of the global climate models even further, and that was being ignored. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason for focusing on the downscaling side of things in that paper, was to capture for them and test whether or not our hypothesis that this was actually reducing the independence was true. The other thing that we wanted to look at was there's a lot of different ways to do that kind of exercise in weighting mm-hmm. That are connected more so with statistics than the physical side. And so we wanted to examine whether or not some statistical approaches were more able at capturing the independence issue that comes from downscaling than others. And so we tested a range of different weighting approaches at the same time. So if you consider our sort of experimental matrix, we had 10 different experiments that we set up mm-hmm. to work with in this particular paper. And that allowed us to explore those different combinations of weighting schemes and whether or not downscaling really did have an influence on what the results of creating a mean projected change off of that set of projections would have meant. Mm-hmm.
So
does that make sense?
Yeah. So when running your experiment, you had 10 different experimental conditions, correct? And I assume at least 8 of them centered around these 4 key ensemble weighting techniques in which you were trying to weight the average of these global climate models. What other conditions compose those experimental conditions? Can you kind of elucidate that a little bit more?
Yeah, certainly. So you're right, we had the 4 different weighting schemes that we mentioned in the paper, but because it is still common practice to do an unweighted mean also, we included that as our other set of experiments. So for each weighting scheme, we had 2 options that we worked with, and then we had the unweighted with its 2 mm-hmm. options. So that's, we end up with 10. The 2 collections of projections were one set that were not downscaled. So the raw global climate model output, and then one set of projections that were downscaled with exactly the same downscaling technique across the whole region. So getting into that common modeling being applied to everything all at the same time. Do you want me to go into the different weighting schemes, or do you?
Sure. If you want to just touch on them, like maybe say, oh, our 10 experimental conditions were like this weighting and downscaling versus not downscaling. And then like just go through mm-hmm. like each one briefly like that. I think that would be good.
Sure. So aside from the unweighted scheme, there were 3 weighting schemes that we used. And that's sort of generic nomenclature here for us, is when we're applying weights to a collection of projections. And for folks unfamiliar, you might hear them referred to as an ensemble. That's the other way we tend to refer to a whole collection of projections, is just as the ensemble, and you have the ensemble members. So that's the jargon breakdown mm-hmm. a little bit there. The other three weighting schemes, they range in complexity. So the most simple sort of weighting scheme that one can look at is just weighting on skill, which is to say, when you look at each member of the collection or the ensemble, how well does it replicate the variable you're interested in over the region? And you weight based upon that. And that's where we were using a simple metric that's root mean square error for each individual model to say, okay, this is how much weight we're going to give it based upon how well it performs in representing that model. So that's totally about the current time. The second technique was where we start getting into combining skill and independence. And there were there in the second and the third, I should say, because there were two variations of that. The second technique was actually used for the last national climate assessment. And this is where the hypothesis that I had came in to begin with, as I was reading the national climate assessment and saw that they applied this with the global models, but not with the downscale data. And the idea there is you have the same root mean square error that gives you a sense of the skill weight, but they have a secondary weight that is based upon the root mean square error of the global climate model evaluated against every other global climate model. The idea being that if that root mean square error of one global climate model with another was really low, those two things were not necessarily independent from each other. They were coming really, really close. And with that in mind, you can then say, okay, how alike is each global model to every other global model in the ensemble, or in the downscaled ensemble, if you were looking at it from the downscaled side. So each of these were applied twice. In that way, they come up with a separate weight for each global model that is its independence weight, or as they also put it, their uniqueness weight. So how unique is the model from every other one? And with that in mind, then they end up combining the two weights together in a simple, it's a simple multiplication of skill weight times uniqueness weight, and then it's normalized so that all the weights would sum to one. This makes it very simple that way. Very easy, very straightforward method that they created. The problem with applying that to the downscale data is it's all about the historical period. Even the independence weight in that particular version of that method was calculated using the historical period. It wasn't calculated using the future projection. Applying that with the downscale data gives you what you'd expect. If downscaling is doing its job correctly, then it ends up pushing every single global climate model in the historical period to look like whatever observation data. So the RMSE goes to be very, very low. So the skill in a downscaled data set is always very high. And because of that, the uniqueness is always very low at the same time. One of the figures in the paper actually shows this pretty clearly with the weights and how that behaved. So what we did also was a second version of that particular weighting scheme that was used in the National Climate Assessment and changed the independence weighting so that it focused on the RMSE of each model versus another for its projected change. So instead of calculating RMSE on the historical period, we calculated it between the different models on that future period and how it projected precipitation. So how is the change signal alike in every different model rather than its historical period? And that allowed us to get around the issue of it's going to inherently be better and be very alike during the historical period, because that's what the downscaling itself was trained on, for lack of a better way to describe it there. But so both of those were also applied to the GCMs and to the downscale data. I apologize if I get a little fuzzy here on occasion.
Oh, you're fine. You're fine.
But the final method is the most complicated of them, and that's the Bayesian model averaging. In a way, the other two methods were very much in the realm of classical statistics, where with a mean, you would have an estimate of standard error, and that would be how you would figure out the uncertainty involved. So the classical statistics kind of approach, you can only look at the mean, which is described as the first moment of the distribution. What Bayesian model averaging lets us do is to look at thousands of different variations of that ensemble with different weights applied to each one. And from there, you figure out the best estimate. But it gives you, with all those different thousands of simulations, a much more careful way to look at the whole distribution of what the mean could be. And so in that sense, you get a much more thorough picture of the uncertainty, and it looks at much more of the moments of many more moments of the distribution for that whole collection of projections. And because of that, you get we hypothesized at the time, a much more thorough and in-depth view of some of the effects the lack of independence can have that you wouldn't see with a weighting scheme that only looks at the first moment of a distribution, if that makes sense. Bayesian model averaging is an interesting beast, and I can certainly provide some references for your readers who are really interested. But the best way to describe it is it looks at much more than just the first moment of the distribution. It looks at the full moment, a full set of moments in the distribution of the ensemble to try and pick the best weights for the ensemble mean. And because of that, we thought we could get more information about the independence out of it.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like when you're conducting this experiment, you were comparing what the downscaled version of this climate model projection was compared to when you didn't downscale it. And if you got the same picture out, you could say that the downscaling was as good as the weighted one. Or if you got a completely different picture or saw a large difference in the error between the ensemble weighted picture and your downscaled picture, then you could say, okay, there's something funky going on here with the original projections. Like, we're not really getting the independence that we're looking for.
That's part of it. I think a better way maybe to describe it is that we recognize that while we were creating all these weights on the global models ensemble, but applying them to everything that was downscaled, we were more so interested in checking whether or not that assumption was reasonable to make. And so we examined carefully how do the weights themselves change when you're using downscaled data versus not downscaled data. But you also then, a couple of figures in the paper is like, well, okay, that's fine. But if you still end up with about the same projected change in the mean that comes, that's one of the figures at the end of the paper, then it doesn't necessarily matter whether or not you're doing downscaling. The weights would not really have all that much of an effect. And what was interesting in finding with that was more so that things that were sort of single moment, the first three weighting techniques and not the Bayesian, it really almost doesn't matter because the image at the end of the paper shows that the projected change ends up being about the same across the region, the mean projected change. But when you use the Bayesian model averaging, you can see that the weights are both dramatically different between downscaled and not, but also at the same time, the projected change as a result of that can look very different. Or I should say the mean projected change. I keep meaning to say that. I apologize. The mean projected change across the region can be very different in a BMA that is using downscaled data versus not. So that's the sort of complicating factor of it, is which weighting scheme are you using. But we did end up generally recommending that folks wanting to do the weighting should consider doing the weighting on the downscale data if that's the ultimate data that they're going to be using at the end, not the global model data.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the limitations when applying this study to research?
So I think a prime limitation that we probably have right now is that this is about precipitation specifically. And precipitation being one of the most difficult things for us to represent in climate models generally, and in downscaling also. This says a lot specifically about that variable. So we haven't done things like temperature yet, although that's another paper I'm actually working on right now, is extending this study to temperature and to other variables to see if that is truly a limitation. We don't think that it is, but that I think is a limitation for this study for now, at least. Is that it just focuses on precipitation. One could argue that it would be limited also by the domain that it's in, although we specifically chose this domain in the South Central U.S. because precipitation in New Mexico is much, much less than precipitation in Louisiana. So it goes from arid to very, very wet. So we were trying to account for a wide range of climatological regimes, so that we wouldn't necessarily be limited by that, and you could apply it elsewhere. But one could argue that for some regions outside of the U.S., this wouldn't necessarily be applicable without testing it for sure. That said, the study has gotten a lot of play in a couple of different places that I know that are making use of it when they're considering doing weighting and assessments so far with the climate projections.
Yeah, that's awesome. Are there any competing interpretations of your data that you've heard as scientists have begun to digest and read it and look at your figures?
To a degree, yes. They don't disagree at least so far as what I've seen thus far. And admittedly, the study only came out in November, so it's it's a little bit still waiting for that. But from what I have seen, it's a question of whether or not it matters as much as we think it does. Because of the one thing that I had mentioned with the simpler weighting schemes, the projected change is not appreciably different. And because of that, well, it doesn't really matter, is the argument there, that what you're saying. But at the same time, we can come back to the other weighting scheme, which gets more into the depth that we want to in assessing changes in the distribution and the whole collection of projections that it does. So one could argue, well, this weighting scheme that we're using is really, really simple, and there doesn't make any appreciable difference, so why should we bother doing this? So that's been the one interpretation that I've heard thus far, where people are just saying it doesn't matter as much as we think it does, which we naturally disagree with that one, given that there's more... There's more of a push to make sure, particularly given how much the projections are being used for things, not just in climate research, but in adaptation and mitigation, wanting to make sure that we're not overconfident with certain things. To us, we think it really does matter to make sure that to capture these things and make sure you're not being overconfident and to actually use stuff with the downscale, use the weighting with the downscale projections instead of just focusing on the global models.
So in your own words, why do you think this type of research is important to pursue? Why should it continue to get funding and attention and importance in the American eye?
The climate projections are being used for so much right now, and particularly the downscaled climate projections, which is to say it's global climate model output that's been downscaled and that we've made projections off of those. And that's why I get so concerned about making sure that what we're providing for decision makers is right, it's accurate, it's not overconfident, because we want to make sure that we're talking about, at this point, multi-billion dollar planning decisions if we're talking about the federal level, and for local levels, it's significant portions of their budget if they're making planning decisions. And I mean, a good example is I had a local emergency manager in Oklahoma come ask us about what climate change was going to do in his tiny area of Oklahoma, because he wants to present to his city council options they can take for resilience planning and management. And so it's a significant portion of the city's budget to be able to have this kind of information prepared for them, make sure it is right and meaningful. I don't want to give something to any decision maker, any manager, any planner that isn't the best that we can give them. And this, so making sure we can overcome those barriers of overconfidence, but also keeping things very skillful, gives a lot of decision makers and planners and impact assessment folks a lot more confidence in using it themselves to make, to do their assessment impacts and vulnerability assessments and also whatever planning decisions they want to make. And that's a lot more confidence that they can share with their, in some cases, their constituents. And also some cases, it's also just their higher ups in representation, if you will. So some managers have to present their work to their local city councils, for instance, or to state officials. So we ultimately do this to make sure that others can make sure they have confidence in what they're doing in their decision-making if they want to plan for it. That's the other thing, is if they want to plan for it. I personally do not push and demand that people plan off of anything that I do, but if you're going to be doing that planning, then I'm going to make my damnedest to make sure that this stuff is actually good and useful for what you need it to be. Mm-hmm. And alongside of just making sure we're actually representing the climate itself to the best of our capability. For ourselves as scientists also, and whatever discoveries that we can find in the future off of climate modeling.
Absolutely. I think we definitely owe our best work to the public, and especially since on a lot of stuff like this, it's publicly funded grant money that we're receiving. Well, you've passed the hard part of the interview. Now comes the next two easiest questions. Okay, I promise. So as a postdoctoral researcher in climate science, what do you spend most of your time doing? You know, what's your job like? If you had to explain it to a group of high schoolers or college students who are interested in going into this field, what would you say?
Goodness, that's a good question, actually. So a lot of what I do on a day-to-day sort of basis involves serious analysis and programming. So most of the time I'm in front of a computer for a fair part of the day doing analysis and number crunching and getting into data. So if you're really into math and statistics and science and computer programming, then climate is a great way to go right now. And getting into climate modeling and analysis is certainly a wonderful way to go. But on my day-to-day, that's what I'm doing, aside from writing. So as a postdoc, you're building your own, you're building your own brand, if you will. You're building your own portfolio and figuring out, this is the kind of things I want to focus on for a fair chunk of the rest of my career, and building that initial base to work from while you're also being mentored by another scientist who's farther along in their career. So eventually you get past postdoc phase and you're on to mentoring other people mm-hmm. yourself, which is always fun too. But that's the basic thing. Aside from that, because of the center that I work in, the specific center that I work in is the South Central Climate Adaptation Science Center, mm-hmm. which is headquartered at the University of Oklahoma. But because the center is what's classified as a boundary organization, which is to say we take research from scientists and do our best to translate it to stakeholders in our region. Mm-hmm. And particularly because the center was founded out of the Department of Interior, a lot of our work is natural resources and cultural resources and working with the tribal nations also. We try to make sure that all of us get out and about and just do some connections and discussing with stakeholders. So a lot of the other things that I do pre-COVID anyway, was actually going out and about and having meetings with stakeholders in different parts of our region. So like one of the last stakeholder trips I was on was a research trip in Texas, in Austin and San Marcos and San Antonio, meeting with stakeholders there, but also going around in New Mexico and Louisiana. And other parts of Oklahoma, just what do people want, and talking about climate change and climate science, and sharing, these are things we know, these are things we don't know, this is how you can use the data if you want to use it, and we're here if you need us, kind of thing. Again, we don't get into political advocacy ourselves. Mm-hmm. We don't get into advocating what kind of policies. We're basically of the mindset that if you want climate information, we're here to help you figure it out, what you need, what you want. Some of the research work that I do ends up being very interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, outside of this particular paper. There's a lot that goes on in day-to-day, but most of the time, particularly in the last year or so, it's been a lot of analysis in front of a computer is what I've been involved with. But it really does give you the opportunity to learn some interesting skills and how to do that analysis. But you also have to figure out how to communicate it in creative ways. Whether it be by video or by webinar at this point.
Yeah. And you know, one thing they don't tell you when you go into graduate school is how much of science is actually writing.
Mm-hmm.
I've really come in and hit a wall on that. It's fun to get into the lab and mess around, but it's another thing when you have to turn around and communicate your results. That's where the rubber really meets the road on that. Well, the last question is one we like to ask all our guests. Do you have anything that you'd like to say to our audience? Particularly about your science or who you are or why you came on the podcast today?
Let's see. So I would say one thing with climate science that I would say is that there's a lot of great stuff and information out there that you can get a hold of from the Climate Adaptation Science Center. So my center is one of eight. So there's multiple centers across the country. There's also the association, the American Association of State Climatologists is a whole other place you can get to. Lots of great resources if you're after more information on climate science and climate change or just climatology in general, I and others can certainly point you to that are much better than going through the media. We'll put that out there. But I'd say if you're really interested in getting into doing climate science, then there's two things I would recommend. And that's, one thing is playing with the data, getting involved in it, asking about it, because data is being what it is sometimes difficult to interpret in the climate side. So getting some expert advice on that is always good. But I would also recommend doing some service trips for those in college, because that's actually something that I did when I was in college, was a lot of service trips to help out in communities battered by extreme events, and seeing the understanding the real human connections that the weather and the climate has to the weather and climate has really very human connections, and understanding that and what it means to people who are not in your own field is really important for driving motivations. Because for me, it's thinking back on all those moments when I'm having a really bad day. It's thinking back on all those moments where I know how people were really affected by something in the extremes, where it gives me motivation to keep on going and want to make sure I can provide the best possible science for people to use in improvement of their own lives and improvement of society.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you're incredibly passionate about your work and very dedicated, and that shows in this paper. So thank you for, you know, all your time and your wonderful answers. We greatly appreciate it. We'd love to have you back on again. So keep us updated on if any new publications you come up with.
Sure, I would be glad to. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course.
Hi, Gina here. Thanks for listening to Science Decoded. We want to thank our host with the most, Justin Dingman, as well as our behind-the-scenes team members, Osama Ilian and Garrett Campion. Our channel artwork was designed by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was written and recorded by Graham Albright. We'd also like to thank our Patreon and local supporters. Without all of you, we couldn't do what we do. SciWorthy is an initiative of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more at www.bluemarblespace.org.